on NPR's Hour of Puzzles, Word Games, and Trivia.
Saturday morning at 11 on AM 580.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We're going to start the program today by taking note of a difficult moment in history. 25 years ago today, the Chinese army attacked demonstrators who'd been occupying Tiananmen Square, protesting for more democracy and freedom. The crackdown brought international condemnation. Some observers believed it would lead the communist country to become increasingly inward-looking and isolated. It turned out that did not happen. Today, China stands as a major global power and one part of the world in which it clearly rivals the U.S. as an influence on politics and the economy is Africa. Thousands of Chinese companies have established themselves in Africa over the last two decades. China-Africa trade has surged from $10 billion in 2000 to $200 billion last year, far surpassing the U.S. and any European country. China's top leaders make multiple trips to the continent every year. But as author Howard French tells us in his new book, just as important as those high-level visits are the people who are rarely discussed, and they are the million or so Chinese expatriates who aren't just passing through, but are staying and moving into all walks of life. That's who the former New York Times bureau chief spent time with as he prepared his latest book, China's Second Continent, How a Million Migrants Are Building a New Empire in Africa. And Howard French is with us now. Welcome back to the program. Thanks so much for joining us.
It's great to be with you again.
Now, you use the word empire in the title, which, of course, conjures up images of European colonialism. What did China's top leaders have in mind? What was their goal in setting their sights on Africa, and have they achieved it?
So in the mid-1990s, the Chinese leadership looked out upon the world feeling, I think, very satisfied that several years after Tiananmen Square, they had managed to really take off economically through a first stage of globalization. But through the 1990s, African leaders were emerging from a period when the West had essentially turned their back on Africa. Africa in the 1980s had been through a very harsh structural adjustment regime imposed most of the time by the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. African economies were in terrible shape, and Westerners had their focus on Eastern Europe for the most part, or in the case of the United States, increasingly on the so-called war on terror. And so Africans were left adrift economically. They didn't have partners who were willing to invest or to do big things. Suddenly along come the Chinese as they were opening up their economy and following the watchword of Jiang Zemin, the president of China in the 1990s, who said, we have to go out into the world to seek new business. And African leaders fell over themselves in enthusiasm for just the notion that anybody would embrace them and do business on a large scale and build big things. Now, a leader wants to be able to point to something that he or she has built and say, okay, so I was in power for 4 or 5 years, and here's the highway I built, or the university I built, or the airport I built, or the stadium I built. And that's exactly what the Chinese were proposing to them. And so you had this great rush of enthusiasm of African leaders competing with each other, actually, in effect, to sign deals with China. And it wasn't until later, until fairly recently, that African civil societies have begun to press their leadership ever more forcefully with skeptical questions about whether this sort of business model is good for the national interest, whether it pays off in the long term, whether in fact it does any good.
Now, in 2008, NPR did a special series on China-Africa relations, and one report featured Zhu Zuting. He is a Chinese business leader who runs a copper mine in Zambia. I just want to play a short clip of what he had to say.
Chinese and Zambian is brothers. You have to know what the local people is thinking. We want to be the best. Number one. It's a win-win project.
So what about that, Professor French? Do the people there feel that way similarly? I mean, do they think it's a win-win?
It's worth pausing to take apart this notion of win-win for a second. The Chinese government has made these immense inroads into the African economic environment over the last 10 or 15 years with a very specific model, which gets back to the notion of imperialism that I hint at in my title. It sends large work crews on big infrastructure projects, which could be highway systems or roads or ports or airports or dams, etc. There could be 500 or 1,000 or 2,000 workers at a go staying in an African country for a year or two to complete these projects very typically. Essentially, all of the labor is done by Chinese people who will live typically in a compound, having relatively little exposure to the African environment and to the local economy. Their salaries is banked back in China. Now, the second piece of this, what I call an economic feedback loop that all goes back to China, in a very profitable way, constitutes the materials, the technology that is used in the building of these projects. That's all sourced in China. And so all of that money goes back to China and not into the African economy. The engineering, the know-how also comes from China, and very little of that is passed on along the way to African collaborators. Finally, all of this is paid for by Chinese state banks, typically with commercial loans. And so the Chinese state banks provide the upfront capital for the big project, and the African country is left to pay back this debt over 20 years or so, directly to China. And so at every level of these kinds of projects, almost all of the money is flowing back to China. And I think this defies any attempt to characterize. African countries are not getting nothing out of this, and they are clearly signing on the dotted line in most cases and contracting these sorts of projects. But I think it makes it hard under the circumstances to agree to this glib characterization as win-win.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Howard French. We're talking about his new book, China's Second Continent, How a Million Migrants Are Building a New Empire in Africa. The former New York Times bureau chief conducted interviews in Mandarin, French, and Portuguese, among other languages, to kind of get to the ground level of how China is influencing the continent. One of the characters that struck a chord with me was Hao Shengli, whom you met in Mozambique. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about his story, if you would. I was struck by the fact that he wanted his sons to marry local women, but I didn't get the sense that this was a love match he was seeking here.
Hao was interesting because, unlike most of the people I profile, he was not a working class person. He'd started up several businesses in China that had done reasonably well. He had some savings. He set off to the Middle East, tried to do business there. He failed. He comes back to China. And he goes to a trade fair and meets some people in Guangzhou who tell him that there's all kinds of opportunity in Africa. And so he then begins to fixate on Africa, and he ends up in Mozambique on the theory that as a Portuguese-speaking country, there'll be very few Chinese people there. He spoke no Portuguese, but he figured at least he wouldn't have any cutthroat Chinese competitors. And so he goes to Mozambique. He doesn't do well in the capital. He discovers, to his disgust, that there are a lot of Chinese people there, in fact. And so he sets off for the countryside, and he ends up finagling his way into buying a very nice piece of irrigated, very rich farmland. And he gets into these relationships with the local people, and their relationship becomes ever more testy. And so he's worrying, even though he's got a long-term lease, he's wondering if the villagers will find a way to contest it or the local government will take it back from him. And he settles upon a scheme, which absolutely astounded me, of bringing his teenage sons from China to settle there with him and to have children by local women in whose names he could place the property and control it indirectly through these people who, as Mozambican citizens, would legally have the right to own land forever. And so that's the scene that I stumble upon in this rural place.
It was interesting to me how much racism you personally encountered over the course of your travels. I mean, just the kind of day-to-day casual reminders of distance that is certainly not polite in this country anymore. I'm thinking about when you went to this hotel in Liberia and then you went to this room to drop off your things and wash up and there was no towel there. And then when you told your hostess, he summoned a young Chinese man who worked for him and told him to fetch me one. He says, we don't usually give them out because most Chinese bring their own. They wouldn't want to use one that a black person might have used. I mean, put this in some context for me. I mean, do you think that this is kind of growing pains and that at some point will people have move beyond that? What's your sense?
Everywhere I went, the local Chinese person referred to the people in whose midst they had come to settle as black people. You know, they would say the blacks, the blacks, the blacks, the blacks. They wouldn't say the Ghanaians or the Tanzanians or the Zambians or the this or the that. It was just the blacks. And this refusal or reluctance to allow any kind of finer identity to render them totally anonymous as just simply black, as if that was the only pertinent detail about them, was very telling for me. That whether or not this is a passing phase, I can't really say, but for the time being, the Africans are just essentially serving as a backdrop for Chinese processes, somebody that will be useful for them or a place that will be useful for them for the time being along the way as they proceed up the ladder of hierarchies, if you will, of civilizations or of nations.
Just as a final thought, that this is very much of an ongoing story, and my sense is that we'll probably be talking again about this in the years to come. But just one final question about the U.S. What does this portend for the U.S. relationship? Can the U.S. catch up? Should they try to compete with China, take a a fresh and more aggressive posture toward the continent?
Africa is not lost to the United States. I would say, though, the biggest handicap that the U.S. faces is totally self-imposed. We have somehow arrived at a place through our own historical processes where we find it almost impossible to regard Africa as a terrain of opportunity. We have conditioned ourselves to regard Africa as a place of tragedy, of disaster, of pain, of poverty, of corruption, and when we're feeling generous, as a place that we need to sort of patronize, to pat on the back or pat on the head, and to do quote-unquote good things in ways that make us feel good about ourselves. This isn't, for the most part, what most Africans expect or want from us as a society. And Africa is in this moment of its history, if I can speak very generally, of immense opportunity. Sub-Saharan Africa, taken as a unit, has a larger middle class than all of India. Africa as a continent has the fastest average rate of growth of any continent in the world. But how many Americans know this? Americans are so deeply conditioned to think about Africa in the terms that I've described that they're blind to these sorts of opportunities. And this is to our detriment. And we're not in a fight with China, but I want to say we're fighting with one hand tied behind our back because, you know, the Chinese don't have this baggage. They don't have this handicap. They don't have any trouble identifying Africa as a place of opportunity. And they have no inhibition about jumping in, obviously, if you have a million people there already in the space of a decade or a little more. They have no inhibition about chasing that opportunity.
Howard French is the author of China's Second Continent, How a Million Migrants Are Building a New Empire in Africa. And he was kind enough to join us from our bureau in New York. Howard French, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Michelle. Great to be with you again.
Coming up, after college graduates are done with the celebrations, it's usually time to get a job. And while this year's graduates have better chances than those in recent times, not everybody is landing that dream job. More on the post-college career picture. That's in just a few minutes on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
I'm Robin Young. Another reason we love our resident chef, Kathy Gunst, how she feels about lettuce.
Seeing tender young greens come up in my garden, I'm like a little kid in a candy store. I am just so excited.
Next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Weekdays starting at noon on AM 580.
Support for WILL comes from Subaru of Champaign County, featuring the standard all-wheel drive Subaru Outback with an EPA highway rating of 29 mpg, depending on conditions. More information is available at their showroom on Route 45 in Savoy or at SubaruofChampaign.com.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. It's June, and that means that nearly 2 million new college graduates are starting the next phase of their lives. And among those who are searching for jobs, it turns out that they may have better odds of finding jobs this year than in the recent past. But it's still tough out there, especially for certain graduates, and we'll have more on that in a few minutes. But for young people overall, there are still high levels of unemployment, and many graduates are being hired into positions that offer low wages and don't require college degrees. Joining us to talk about the good, the bad, and the ugly news for the class of 2014 is Marilyn Gwex. She's a senior business news editor at NPR. Welcome back. Thanks for joining us once again.
Hi, Michelle.
So what's the big picture? What measure are analysts using to suggest that there is a brighter outlook this year?
Well, there's an organization, the National Association of Colleges and Employers. Every spring they do a survey to see how things are going, and this year it's showing that employers are expecting to hire nearly 9% more college graduates, and they're planning to pay them 1.2% more than they did last year. So that's, you know, that's the right direction. You want to see hiring up, and you want to see wages going up, and the overall economy seems to be stronger. The last 3 months we've had more than 200,000 new jobs for each month. We'll get a new report on Friday, but in general, it's looking better. Let's just say if you had an older sibling who was class of 2009, you're lucky you're you this year, because it's better than it was a few years ago.
So what are the challenges that are still out there?
The big problem for a lot of college graduates is not so much finding a job, but finding a job you actually want and that pays you something decent. The Labor Department says the unemployment rate for college graduates is about 3.3%. In other words, full employment. You can get a job if you're a college graduate. The problem is, when you look at the statistics, about 4 out of 10 are in jobs that really don't require a college education. In other words, you graduate from college, and yes, someone wants to hire you, but you're working in a retail sales job at the mall, you're really not in the field that you wanted to be in.
And of course, that has implications for people who don't have college graduates, because people with those
right.
degrees are kind of crowding out people who otherwise would have those opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
But talk about another issue, if you would, that's been in the news a lot in recent years, which is the level of debt that college
yes.
graduates are bringing with them to get that degree.
The Senate just had another hearing this morning about student debt, and you know the numbers there are terrible. There's about $1.2 trillion in student debt, and that's spread over about 40 million people. The typical student debt is about $33,000 this year, and that's a record. It's twice, even after you adjust for inflation, it's about twice what it was 20 years ago. So there are lots of people graduating who are getting jobs. Yes, it's good to be a college graduate, but the jobs are too often not in something that pays well, and the students are heavily burdened with debts.
Is there any advice that you feel comfortable giving to recent college graduates who are on the market and looking for those first opportunities?
Well, I am certainly not, I want to be clear, I'm not a guidance counselor, but I do look at data, and it's just overwhelmingly clear that the jobs that are really paying right now are all the jobs that I would find awful, but, computer science, engineering, accounting. The best job out there, the statistics show, is to be a petroleum engineer. Starting salaries, 22-year-olds coming out of college are being offered jobs at more than $95,000 a year. So if you want to be a 23-year-old making in the six figures, be a petroleum engineer. But, you know, that's a very tough way to go. The jobs that tend to not pan out are those that are like media studies and psychology and arts. Those kinds of softer majors are still having pretty low salaries, and that's where the trouble really is.
Meaning us.
Looking at ourselves, yes, we are typical examples of what's a real problem. But, you know, there are more problems, though, that even if you have the kind of degrees that we have in journalism, the real problems for people are dithering. I mean, no matter what your major is, yes, it's great to be a petroleum engineer, but if you're going to graduate in journalism, make sure you're doing it the right way. That is, do it in 4 years. Don't drag it out over 6 years. That's a
Why?
Real problem.
Why? Because of the debt load?
Because it tends to increase
the debt, and then it becomes harder to pay off the debt, and your options are limited.
And you're coming out of school, you're 24, 25 years old, and there are already people, you know, running up your back who are 22 years old, and it sort of looks better to an employer to see somebody who's been really aggressive about finishing school in 4 years. And the other thing that you really need to keep in mind is the value of internships. That on the one hand, yeah, you want to graduate in 4 years, but you want to make sure that you've layered in during those 4 years ways to get your foot in the door. That's what the statistics really show, is that people who have managed to get some work experience and finish in a timely fashion, get good grades, those are the things that tend to help you get through school. And, you know, the problem, I think, is we all have a kind of an image of college should be fun. You know, it's beer and football, and that's nice. We all did a little of that. But you also have to realize that going to college is a job that has to be taken seriously, or you end up with that $33,000 in debt, you're 25 years old, you've changed majors 3 times, and those are the people that really end up having a lot of trouble in the job market.
Marilyn G. Wax is a senior business news editor at NPR with us once again in our Washington, D.C. studios. Thanks, Marilyn.
Oh, you're welcome.
So let's focus this conversation a little bit more. Remember I said earlier that there is a mixed picture for new graduates? Well, the going is tougher for new graduates who are Black, even if they studied high-demand fields like engineering. A recent report from the Center for Economic and Policy Research titled A College Degree is No Guarantee says that last year about 12% of Black college graduates between the ages of 22 and 27 were unemployed. For all college graduates in the same age range, that's graduates of all races, the unemployment rate was about half that. Of course, we assume that there's a lot going on behind these numbers, so we have two guests with us to talk about this issue and what Black graduates face as they search for jobs this summer and why. Janelle Jones is a research associate at the Center for Economic Policy and Research. She is one of the authors of the report. She's with us in our studios in Washington, D.C. Welcome. Thanks for coming.
Thanks so much for having me.
Also joining us is Professor Nancy DiTommaso. She is Vice Dean for Faculty and Research at Rutgers Business School, Newark and New Brunswick. Nancy is also the author of the book, The American Non-Dilemma, Racial Inequality Without Racism, and we are speaking to her from member station WBGO in Newark. Professor DiTommaso, thanks so much for joining us once again.
Thank you for having me.
So, Janelle, let's start with you. The report says that compared to non-Black graduates, Black graduates are twice as likely to be unemployed. And one of the things that stands out to me is something I mentioned earlier. This is true even in high-demand fields. For example, 10% of Black college graduates with computer-related fields were, 10% of Black college graduates in engineering and 11% with math and computer-related fields were unemployed. That's compared with 6% of engineering grads and 7% of all math grads. So the obvious question is why?
Right. Yeah. So we do talk about that in the report. And we also, you talked about the numbers for engineering. 32% of Black college graduates between the ages of 22 and 27 are underemployed. 32%.
I'm going to get to that.
Right.
I'm going to get to the underemployed as well, but I want to specifically, what's the why?
Right. Well, the why is definitely a weak labor market. We have, we've seen that we're basically in recovery, but these young African-American graduates are definitely not feeling recovered. So the weak labor market definitely has something to do with it. And we also talk a little bit about racism in the report.
We'll talk a little bit more about racism in the report. Let's hear about it.
Sure. So, we list a couple of studies where you show you basically have a Black applicant and a white applicant. You send out the exact same resume. White applicant's more likely to get a callback. And even when in the report, we look at, by major. So these are people who have studied the same thing. They're the same age. And Blacks are more likely to be unemployed. So, it's not skills, it's not experience, it's something else. And we think that something else is labor market discrimination.
And talk about the underemployment. As you mentioned, that we've also talked about unemployment, but you said that the high percentage of Black graduates are underemployed, meaning they're working at jobs for which they are overqualified, and that's more likely to be the case. And why do we think that is?
Right. Well, again, racism in the weak labor market have something to do with it. More than half of these Black college graduates are in jobs that don't require a degree. And that's just, that really blows my mind. You go to school, you stay, you finish, you get a job, and it doesn't require a degree. That is just incredibly discouraging, and it's something that, a lot of people are dealing with.
So, Professor DiTommaso, let's turn to you now. The Atlantic did a piece about this report, and you are quoted in it, and you say, this study, its findings, as terrible as they are, honestly should not come as a shock to anybody who's willing to face the truth about employment and unemployment in the United States. So talk about that. Why do you think that is true?
Well, first of all, there is context to these kinds of numbers. The same kinds of proportions have actually been in effect or been represented in the job market for at least the last 50 years. 50 years or so, the ratio of white unemployment to Black unemployment was about 2.1, and more recently it's about 2.2, meaning that twice as many Blacks are unemployed as whites, both 50 years ago and now, and although there's been some minor variations across year depending on the economic conditions of the country, it's really been about the same ratio for a very long time.
Is there anything, and I understand that you're saying that this has been true for the past 50 years, but is there anything in the present moment that makes the underemployment and unemployment of Black graduates unique? Anything at all?
Well, certainly the economic crisis that started in 2008 and the very slow recovery since then has exacerbated whatever kinds of processes or mechanisms already were at play. But I wanted to call attention to an issue that I've been trying to raise when these kinds of discussions come up, which is that one could take exactly these same numbers of the unemployment rate, the underemployment rate, the issues regarding new graduates trying to get jobs or people in different kinds of fields trying to get jobs, and turn it around. Instead of saying that blacks are more likely to be unemployed or that they're more likely to be underemployed and so on, you could use those very same numbers and say that whites are more likely to get jobs and they are less likely to be underemployed. So again, in my analysis and research, I think that the dynamics is not so much racism and discrimination, although I'm sure that those exist, as it is that the job market in general works in terms of people helping each other, and whites help other whites get jobs. And when the number of jobs available are very tight and scarce, those kinds of processes are even more likely to take place. And so whites are, if you will, overemployed or overrepresented in the available opportunities. And I think that's the dynamic that is more important to look at because it's one that we haven't given enough attention to.
I want to hear more about that for those who are interested in this question, and I assume that's many people who want to know what the situation is for other minorities. It falls somewhere in between that of blacks and whites, according to the federal data. In 2013, the share of all college-educated Asian Americans who were unemployed roughly equaled the proportion of whites, but all Hispanic college graduates faced a 5% unemployment rate, which is more than whites but less than African Americans. So let's wheel around, and Professor DiTomaso, let's talk about, and Janelle, I want to hear from you too as well, as this. What's the right approach to this? How would you say, what is the best way to address this for people who believe that this gap is unacceptable, given that the message that, you know, policymakers, educators, parents are all saying, if you get the right skills, that will address the problem. These data suggest that is not necessarily the case. So, Professor DiTomaso, you've studied this quite closely. What do you say to that? If you say the issue is that whites tend to help whites, which tends not to be illegal, right? Or at least there's no federal, right. There's no specific prohibition against that. It's called kind of networking. But what do you say? What's the right way to address this?
Well, first of all, it's consequential if whites help other whites and other groups help those that are like themselves as well. But whites are disproportionately in the positions where they get to make the decisions about who gets hired, who has opportunities. They're more likely to be in jobs with higher incomes, with more authority, with more training, and so on. And therefore, when we have these kinds of processes where jobs are obtained or more likely because of these kinds of networking processes, it's very consequential in terms of reproducing inequality. And that can take place without necessarily using racism as an explanation. Again, it's from my perspective, it's more the favoritism that whites show toward other whites than it is the discrimination or racism that whites show, certainly intentionally, toward blacks or other non-whites. So what does one do about it? I think that it's important on the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights Act to raise these issues again in terms of a policy level, a collective level. There needs to be attention to how these kinds of decisions about who gets hired and who gets jobs and what kinds of opportunities are available. It used to be that at least in the early days of the passage of the Civil Rights Act and then following with executive orders, that affirmative action was seen as a particular solution. And again, if you see affirmative action not as a way to give preferences to blacks, but to stop giving preferences to whites, then that policy, in fact, was very effective in terms of changing some of the picture in terms of who had access to certain kinds of jobs. At the organizational level, companies can also pay more attention to the kind of biases that decision makers make for whites as opposed to the biases against blacks, which is where all of their attention has been focused.
I need to give Janelle a chance to weigh in on this question as well. So Janelle Jones, final thought from you?
Sure. So I think that one thing that we've seen is that when the labor market is doing well for everyone, blacks tend to kind of rise with that tide. So the strongest period of growth for wages and labor market opportunities for African Americans was when, the entire economy was at full employment in the early 2000s. So I think that, the likelihood of getting kind of a national policy that addresses blacks getting better jobs is not likely. So I think that, one way we can do this is really focus on full employment for everyone and recovering the labor market at the bottom.
Janelle Jones is a research associate at the Center for Economic Policy and Research. She's one of the authors of the report, A College Degree is No Guarantee. She joined us in our studios in Washington, D.C. Rutgers University professor Nancy DiTomaso is author of The American Non-Dilemma, Racial Inequality Without Racism. We spoke to her from member station WBGO in Newark. I thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thanks so much.
Coming up, the Tony Awards are this weekend, and the Broadway revival of A Raisin in the Sun is up for 5 prizes. The play debuted more than 50 years ago, but nominee Anika Noni Rose says the story is still relevant today.
Yes, it is specifically about the black experience in that time period. It is also a play about family and about the American dream.
Tony Award-winning actress Anika Noni Rose. That's just ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from LifeLock, reminding consumers that identity thieves target bank and savings accounts of victims. Learn more at LifeLock.com/NPR. From the Kresge Foundation, expanding opportunities in America's cities at Kresge.org. From Cancer Treatment Centers of America, offering genomic testing that may reveal other treatment options for individual cancer patients at CancerCenter.com. And from Joyce V. Hale, in the interest of engaging an informed and civil electorate. This is NPR.
California chose to do something about the undocumented immigrants driving there illegally. Have them apply for a license. It could make California roads safer when applicants pass one of the country's toughest driving tests.
Sometimes the questions are a little tricky.
Undocumented drivers in California cram for the exam. Next time on The World.
Weekday afternoons at 3 on AM 580.
Hi, I'm Diane Noland, host of Mid-American Gardener on WILL-TV. Join me and my panel of experts each week as we discuss lawn and gardening care tailored to Zone 5 growing conditions. We'll also answer your gardening questions, so call in during the show or send an email for us to answer on the air. Join me for Mid-American Gardener Thursday nights at 7 on WILL-TV or listen Saturday mornings at 6:30 on AM 580.
Today's programming is made possible in part by the Friends of WILL and by Country Financial Representative Scott Jackson, Village at the Crossing in Champaign, committed to helping clients achieve financial security through effective planning. Online at scottjacksonfinancial.com.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Now, you may think you know the play A Raisin in the Sun from its many stage and screen performances, but the latest revival starring Denzel Washington, Sophie Okonedo, and Anika Noni Rose is bringing new life into the American classic. The production has already received 5 Tony Award nominations, including one for Anika Noni Rose's performance as the spirited aspiring doctor Benita Younger.
The ambulance came and they took him to the hospital and they fixed up the broken bones and they sewed it all up. And the next time I saw Rufus, he just had a little line down the middle of his face. I never got over that.
What?
That was what one human being could do for another. Fix him up. You know, sew up the problem, make him all right again. That was the most marvelous thing in the world, and I wanted to do that.
And Anika Noni Rose is with us now. Welcome. Congratulations. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
Is this a part that you really wanted to do, or was this something that you had to be persuaded to do?
It wasn't something that I was thinking, wow, I would really love to do A Raisin in the Sun. Now in it and doing it was my own mistake. And fortunately, sometimes opportunity knocks twice, and sometimes when you least expect it, because I'm really, really happy to be in it. And as I started to read the play, which I hadn't read in a very, very long time, it became very clear to me how relevant this play is for now, for 2014, while speaking very clearly to the time period that it was written for. So I knew of Benita as an amazing character. I just didn't know how awakening she would be for now.
I want to talk a little bit more about that, but I did want to ask a little bit more about how you came to do this part.
Kenny Leon, the director, offered me the role, and we had worked together last spring on a television movie, The Watsons Go to Birmingham. So he called to ask if I wanted to do the role, and I said, yes. And, you know, it's interesting because I was thinking of it more as something that I was doing for my parents, really, for my mom, you know, sort of a tribute to her and a gift to her, because I know what it meant to her growing up, this play, this piece. And now I feel that it has also been a great gift for myself and to myself.
You know, I have to ask the Denzel question, so the Denzel question.
Yeah, we're having a fabulous time. I think we're really lucky with this cast. He could stand out there and wield his stardom all over the stage and make it difficult, you know, for everyone. But that's not what happens. He's very generous on stage. I think we are lucky to have a cast full of generous people who are there to tell the story and enjoy each other. And because of that, we are able to trust each other on stage. And I think that's the most important thing that you should have in a stage show. You have to be able to trust each other because it's live, because anything could happen, because we are the only safety nets that the other person has. And the interesting thing about the play is that you learn that the spotlight, the sun shines on every person in this play at a different time. He could play it like it's Walter Lee's play and it's all about him, but it's all about everyone. And that's the wonderful thing, I think, about this production, because it allows the script to do what the script is meant to do.
Let's talk about the play for those who are not familiar with it. It's about an African-American family who are in tight quarters. And, you know, the center of the play is Walter Lee Younger, who's played in this production by Denzel Washington. Mm-hmm. And some insurance money is coming. And there's a discussion, like, what do they do with it? And one of the dilemmas is, should they move to the suburbs or not? In your character, you want to be a doctor. One of the tensions is, should this insurance money be used to support your education? Should it be used to help Walter run a business because he's working as a chauffeur and he's frustrated mm-hmm. by the fact that he wants to be somebody? Or should it go to this house? Like, what should they do with this money? What is it about this part that you feel speaks to you?
Well, I think there's, at this point in our lives, there's a great rift between the haves and the have-nots. And I think that crosses cultural barriers, that rift. And a lot of people can understand not being able to do things for lack of funding or for lack of a social connection, or because of some unspoken but very clear prejudice against them. People that are trying to move upward, be upwardly mobile, often feel that they have to leave the traits that they have that make them specifically themselves, put them in a box and hide them somewhere so that they can fit in to move up. And beneath it is someone who wants to move up and move forward, but is not willing to release her person and the thing that gives her strength or the thing that gives her culture and leave that behind. She is going to move forward and move up, and she is going to take all of who she is with her. And I think that that is a challenge that many, many people face today.
What do you think the people coming to this play fresh will get from it? That, you know, it's, a lot of people grew up with this play. It was kind of part of their, you know, cultural learning. But some people are coming to it new, especially even people who didn't grow up in the United States, right? Who are, and I'm wondering, what do you think they'll get from it now?
First of all, it is a great American classic. It is part of the American canon, and rightfully so. Lorraine Hansberry, at 28 years old, penned this play that has people of completely different backgrounds sitting in the audience every night. And, you know, you hear, and, oh, and, ooh, from people all from different places and different histories.
And don't forget,
And, oh, no. At one point, I have something that I say to my mom that was not the nicest thing to say. And this woman in the audience says, oh, shame on you. And the lights came up, and it was this older white woman who was just disgusted with me and my character in that moment. And I love that she was in this play, because people would have you to believe, because of the faces that the play is written on, that is the only demographic for this play. And the truth of the matter is that Lorraine Hansberry has written an extraordinarily American play. Yes, it is specifically about the Black experience in that time period. But she is such a genius that she wrote a play that has specificity, but also has universality, because it is also a play about family and about the American dream and about reaching for that and how out of reach it can seem, you know. So there are so many themes that move through this. I had a friend who is Puerto Rican by birth and grew up in primarily in Jersey. And he came and he said that the moment he saw Travis, who's played by Bryce Clyde Jenkins, he's my nephew in the play, sleeping on that couch made up like a bed, he started to cry. He said, because that was how he grew up in New Jersey in the projects. That was his growing up experience. And he felt like it was a kick in the gut to see himself in that boy on that stage. You know, so I think that people are taking away a lot from it. It depends on where you are in your life, what that message is that you take with you.
Well, you've had an amazing ride. You were nominated for Best Performance by an Actress in a Featured Role. This is your second Tony nomination. You've also got the film Half of a Yellow Sun, and the movie based on the novel of the same name by Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie takes place in Nigeria during the Biafran War. You play a successful businesswoman and a socialite whose life contrasts with her twin sister. Let me just play a clip just to whet people's appetite. You can tell me what that experience was like.
You realize, don't you, that you've just cost Daddy the contract?
It's not as if he'll get nothing. Daddy'll still give him 10% after all.
Well, the 10% is standard, so extras always help. The other bidders probably don't have a beautiful daughter.
What was that experience like?
It was amazing. It's an intense film. It was an intense shooting experience. We spent 2 months in Calabar, Nigeria, and it was really a learning set. So we had a lot of crew from South Africa, where they make movies all the time, regularly. And then we had a lot of local crew who, some people had never made films before, and they were very new to it and learning as they went along, but very quickly picked up. So it was a really interesting experience. And, you know, there were times, there was a time where we did makeup by the light of a cell phone, because the electricity had gone out and the generator wasn't working, and that's what we did. But everybody on that set from the locals to people who were brought in, believed in the film so much and believed in the story so much that we all found ways to make it work when nature would conspire against us. It was a really wonderful experience, and it was good to be there amongst the people of Nigeria and taking that culture in while telling this story.
If you're just joining us, we are speaking with Anika Noni Rose. She is nominated for her second Tony Award for her role as Benitha in the Broadway revival of A Raisin in the Sun. You were the first African-American princess to be featured in a Disney film. To my daughter, you will always be Princess
yes.
Tiana
yes.
from Princess and the Frog. Will you forgive me if I play a clip just because for my 10-year-olds in the audience?
Time for dancing. That's just gonna have to wait a while.
How long we talking about here?
Ain't got time for messing around. And it's not my style.
I want some grandkids.
This old town can slow you down. People taking the easy way. But I know exactly where I'm going. I'm getting closer and closer every day.
That was a very big deal to a lot of people. Did it feel like a big deal at the time?
It felt like a big deal on many levels. I don't think I understood how huge it would be for other people. It was so big for me. I always wanted to be a Disney voice, and I wasn't really a princess kid. So I enjoyed the princess movies, but I also loved like the Lady and the Tramp and the Fox and the Hound and those types of things. So I had my mind on like an animal or an inanimate object, to be perfectly honest. So when the princess came around, like that was beyond even the dream that I had. I cried when I got the news, and I called my mother, and I just was so blown away. And it really wasn't until we were really in it, and they were really good about surprising me with things too. Like they unveiled at a toy fair, they were like, oh, Anika, we want you to just look at this little clip and make sure it's all right and you like it, because that's what we're going to show. And then they showed me myself in color for the first time, and I cried, and I cried when I saw the doll for the first time. And I, you know, but it wasn't really until I started meeting children and parents, and there was a man, older black man, who came up to me to meet me. He recognized me, and he came up to me, and he shook my hand, and he started to cry because he said it was the first time that he was able to buy his child a doll that looked like her. Mm-hmm. And I think not that there weren't other brown dolls on the market, but this time it was a princess. And she wanted to be a princess. She felt that she was a princess, and her parents told her she was a princess. But now this doll is also telling her that she was a princess. I think that the beautiful thing, aside from the fact just that it was that it's done and it's there for perpetuity, is that it has taught little brown girls to look at themselves as regal creatures of bearing, and that they are deserving of being the princess. It validates that dream. And it also teaches their classmates who may not look like them that you can look at this little girl and see her as the princess as well. And this is not something that I think that they are thinking. That's what's the lovely thing about it. It's just something that happens because children change the world very differently than adults do. They're not out pushing and shoving. Their mind is just opened up because they saw someone who they related to, not because of their skin color necessarily for the children who aren't brown, but because they loved her and they related to her and they wanted to be her. And for the children that are brown, you know, they have all of those things too, but they also see someone that reminds them of them and of their mommy and of their sisters and their cousins.
Do you feel a little bit more of a princess yourself now?
You know, I do. It's a very, very special thing to be a part of the Disney canon and to be a part of Americana that way, because Disney is Americana. You know, and I can go almost anywhere in the world and people know Princess Tiana. The fact that she is worldwide is beautiful. And it also, you know, it sort of, it knocks down the lie that we don't sell overseas, that people don't want to see stories that have our faces on them, because we're told that very often. But I can tell you, standing in Dublin, Ireland, surrounded by a sea of enamored little Irish children with their eyes huge who had just seen the piece, that it's simply not true.
Well, see, what's next, though? Now you've got, you know, American film, blockbuster, Dreamgirls, you know, Broadway, Tony Award, you're a Disney princess. You work with Denzel Washington, you know. What else is there?
An action movie.
An action movie.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, is that right? Are you going to be against the green screen?
I don't know how it's going to work out, but it's in my plans. Yeah, I want to fly through the air and, like, kick somebody in the neck and take them down. And how much fun would that be? I want to control the elements. I want to read somebody's mind. I want to do all that stuff. I just think that is so much fun.
Well, you've put it out there. I'm sure it's going to happen. Anika Noni Rose is a Tony Award-winning actress. She is nominated for another Tony for her performance in the revival of A Raisin in the Sun, which is on Broadway now. And she was kind enough to join us in our bureau in New York. Anika Noni Rose, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Michelle.
That's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.